The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Nearly 3 years ago, the team at CERN operating the Large Hadron Collider astounded the world with the discovery of the Higgs boson. Now, after a two-year refit and upgrade, almost doubling its power, they have their sights set on capturing dark matter and making scientific history for a second time. We'll be talking to Mike Lamont, the operations group leader at CERN, plus John Butterworth, professor of physics at University College London, and Daniela Bortoletto, who's also a professor of physics at the University of Oxford. Both work on the ATLAS experiment at CERN. Also in the pod is Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of the Observer's Tech Monthly, to talk us through a new generation of apps and trips to Venus. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. At 8:30 on Sunday morning, scientists sent two beams of protons racing through 16.7 miles of the Large Hadron Collider's circular underground tunnels. The restart involved relatively weak beams of particles being sent around the tunnel ring in both directions. The first collisions between the particles, marking the start of a new phase of experiments, will not take place until June. With its energy doubled to 13 tera electron volts, the hope this time is that the LHC will shine a light on dark matter, extra dimensions, supersymmetry, the list is endless. On the phone now from Geneva is Mike Lamont, the operations manager of CERN's beam department. Mike, how has the restart gone so far?
Well, okay, on Sunday we took beams in for the first time. We take them around step by step, correcting as we go, and then we let them go. Both beams immediately performed multiple turns. It's then the turn of the RF system, the radio frequency system, to capture and bunch the beams. And then we say we have circulating beams. So this all went very smoothly. And we're quite experienced in this now. So by later Sunday afternoon, we had both beams in good shape, circulating in opposite directions.
So you had both beams of protons going around in opposite directions. At the moment, these are at low energy, right?
This is at injection energy, so this is 450 GeV. We haven't been above that yet. So, and again, it should be emphasized, this is also low intensity. So we're working with one probe bunch, as we call it. So it's not even a kind of nominal intensity bunch. There's this very low intensity protons. So we can mess around we can commission stuff without any risk of damage at this stage.
And by intensity, that means essentially the number of protons per bunch or what?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, more accurately, it would be bunch population. So at the moment, we're working with about 5 10 to the 9. A nominal is about 1 10 to the 11.
That's 5 billion bunches of protons?
That's 5 billion protons.
Okay.
So, Yeah, 5 10 to the 9 is 5 billion protons, and we will eventually work with about 100 billion protons.
Okay. What is the team doing now?
So at the moment, we're really in a system commissioning stage. So at the end of the day, we've got to take an awful lot of protons, a lot of bunches, up to 6.5 TeV. Now, this really gets dangerous. So we end up with something like 340 megajoules per beam. That's about equivalent to a TGV going 140 kilometers an hour. So if we're not very, very careful, of course, we're going to end up with a massive train wreck and severe damage. So the real emphasis at this stage is to set up, make sure all our protection systems are working properly. So at the moment, the beam dump guy, as we speak, the beam dump team are in there going through systematic checks that all the systems connected to the beam dump are working properly, all their timing's correct, all their links to other equipment is okay.
The machine has had a lot of work done on it in the past 2 years. Does it feel to you like you're working with pretty much a new machine or an unfamiliar machine, or is this all working pretty much as it was with LHC Run 1?
It's a very familiar machine, it has to be said. I mean, we've had some novel problems because we're pushing things harder. the power converter, the power supplies, other systems. But at 450 GeV, it's very, very, you know, it's very, very familiar.
What new challenges are there for you going to this higher energy? What are the things that you have to look out for at these energies you're going for that maybe weren't such a big issue first time around?
One, we're going to be very, on the magnets themselves, we're going to be closer to the quench level. So it's not going to take too much to actually quench a magnet. So this could be beam, or it could be just natural quenches of the magnets themselves.
And what do you mean, just for listeners who don't know about quench magnets, what do you mean about a quench, and what are the consequences of that?
So if say we dump particles into a magnet, we can heat it locally, and we can make and cause a transition from the superconducting state to the resistive state. And this is what we call a quench. Now, over the last 6 months, we got a very sophisticated quench protection system in place to catch this. Okay, the first thing that's done is we dump the beams. We then extract all the energy as fast as we can out of the magnets, power off, and handle that transition safely. So these are the tests that have been going on, I say, for about 6 months now to make sure all that works flawlessly without beam.
What if it doesn't work? What is the danger if you get a quench and you don't have that protection in place?
You end up, well, this has been this has been during the prototype stage. This has been demonstrated firsthand, and you can end up with a hole in your magnet like that with burnt through coil without the actual sort of superconducting windings of the magnet burned locally. So this would be, you know, and that would involve a magnet change, and we'd be off for 2 to 3 months while that was fixed.
Okay. I'm sure you'll be avoiding that. Just give us a thoughts on when you think you might be going for first collisions.
First collisions with the experiments on, so when they can safely take data, so we guarantee that we're not going to spray them with beam, is we reckon about 8 weeks from now. So as I say, again, this will be initially with low intensity, a low number of bunches, and then we'll kind of ramp up gradually after that. So again, with one eye on this, the damage potential of this beam and the need to check very, very carefully as we move up in beam energy.
What's the mood like out there, Mike?
it's sort of manic humor and long hours, shall we say. It's optimistic. This is exciting times. It's been a long time since we've had beam, so we're working 24 hours a day at the moment. So teams coming in working overnight doing these checks and measurements, but a lot of enthusiasm. The experiments last night took splashes, so we actually, Atlas and CMS, so we actually dumped beam on the collimators just upstream of them, showering them with particles so they can actually time in their detectors and triggers and stuff like that. So we got our first bottle of champagne of run two. So the mood is fairly buoyant at the moment.
Brilliant. Well, look, good luck with the rest of it, and we'll be watching, and fingers crossed for everything.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Thanks to Mike Lamont there. Joining us in the studio is John Butterworth, Professor of Physics at UCL, Nicola Davis, the Commissioning Editor of Tech Monthly and The Observer, and down the line from Oxford is Daniela Bartoletto, who's also a Professor of Physics. Welcome to you all. John, let's start with you. The Large Hadron Collider closed down soon after CERN found the Higgs boson. You must be itching to get going again.
Yes, I think the atmosphere changes when you have data. I mean, to be fair, we're still publishing papers. We ran up for 6 months after we discovered the Higgs, and we analyzed all that data, and we're still publishing papers using that data. And it's kind of, there's still, I guess, the real precision measurements, they take a long time, but yeah, we're looking for some new data as well. That's very exciting to have the accelerator alive again.
You've shown that this Higgs boson is there, or a Higgs boson, or a particle that looks like the Higgs boson, however you want to phrase it, that a particle like that is there.
It's the Higgs boson, yeah. Right? It's the one in nature. Whether it's the one in the theory is a different matter, but it's the one in nature.
Right, okay. Do you not just move on now? You tick that box. Yes, the Higgs was real, as predicted in 64. Or what else do you need to do around the Higgs now? And, you know, is that going to be a kind of a prime goal of this second run of the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, in a sense, we have moved on in that we've answered a big question. So it's not like we're back where we were. But because these collisions are essentially quantum mechanical, right? They're random, they're stochastic. So the more data you get, the more you shrink the error bars down on any measurement. And that's the kind of the thing we know we will do with the new run, is that we will just collect more data. We will collect more Higgs bosons and watch how they decay, and we will measure its properties more precisely. We will also, because we have more energy, which is probably the most important thing about the new run actually, is that we will go up in energy. We will be able to see more. We'll be able to see the structure of matter in more detail. We'll be able to search for heavier particles. Maybe there are more Higgs bosons out there. Maybe there's more stuff we don't understand. And also, where the Higgs is, it's connected with this thing we call electroweak symmetry breaking, which is a scale where this two of the fundamental forces of nature come together. There's an electromagnetic force and a weak force. And they come together, it's connected with the Higgs, it's connected with the mass of the particles that carry these forces. And we're really exploring now above that scale, and the higher energy that the LHC will have will give us more room to explore above that scale. And if there was no Higgs boson, we'd have no theory predicting what to expect up there. Now there is a Higgs boson, we have precise predictions for what should happen in the standard model, but those predictions need to be confronted with the data.
Daniele, you were on the other multi-purpose detector at the LHC, CMS, before moving to ATLAS, I believe. But both detectors got slightly different masses for the Higgs boson. Is that something that you'll be clarifying with this next run? Does it actually matter?
I believe that actually we have already clarified it. As you know, we have just very recently published a combined measurement of the Higgs boson mass, which is sort of clarifying because, you know, we were getting slightly different masses at CMS and ATLAS and slightly different masses in the decay of the Higgs to photon and in the decay of the Higgs to four leptons, okay? But the combination is remarkably spot on, and the result of the combination, it's really a fantastic error, a very tiny error on the Higgs of 0. The mass is 125 GeV plus or minus 0.24 GeV. So really a quarter of percent error. So it's already a remarkable result out of this current run. We will do it better in the future, but I think that we are already doing it extremely well now.
What is the question about the Higgs that you really want answered from this run?
Well, I honestly think that, you know, I'm following up a little bit on what John said already. First of all, I think that for the first time, we have a scalar particle in our hand. We have never seen a scalar before. We know that, you know, that the matter particles are spin 1/2, are fermions. We know that the carriers that mediate interaction are spin 1 particle, are vector bosons. And the Higgs is a first scalar, so it's nor matter nor force, let's say. So it's really quite remarkable. So in surface, all the properties that we have measured up to now seem to indicate that the Higgs is pretty much like the standard model particles, okay? So I think that we will have to work pretty hard, you know, in order to see if the Higgs hold any secrets beyond what it said to us already. I think that it's very important that we measure all the coupling of the Higgs to all the generation of fermions. You know, at the moment, we have just measured mainly only the coupling of the Higgs boson to the W and the Z boson to other to vector bosons. And at the moment, we know the coupling of the Higgs to the top quark. We have measured not very well the coupling of the Higgs to the tau. So we really have to complete even the measurement of the Higgs boson to the third generation, which is the heavier of the three generations. So the one to which the Higgs coupling more strongly, if you want. But again, with the next run, we will be able to probe the coupling to the second generation. We will be able to start measuring the coupling of the Higgs to muons, for example, which is a very tiny cross-section. And to measure the Higgs to mu plus mu minus, the coupling of the Higgs to muons, for example, we will need all data samples that we will get at the end of the LHC program. You know, when we will have actually not only the higher energies that the next run brings, but also the higher interaction rates that the high LUMI LHC, the high luminosity LHC will bring.
Just help me with some of the terminology here. So we've got, you talk about a scalar particle, you talk about couplings and cross sections. Is there some way for our listeners who don't know a lot about high energy physics to get a grip on what some of these things mean? First of all, when you talk about a scalar particle, what's so briefly so interesting about a scalar particle? What is that?
So a scalar particle is a particle that doesn't carry any spin.
Okay, fair enough.
I think opened a Pandora's box, yeah. Right?
I think, just to elaborate on that a little bit, spin is angular momentum. It's really as though the particle is spinning. It's not really, but it's a bit like that. And that gives it a direction. So if you've got a spin, you kind of have a north pole and a south pole, or like the Earth does, you know. And that's important. The Higgs has to be like that, because otherwise it can't be this field that fills the universe and gives everything mass. So it's a really important property of it. And all the other particles we know of have spin. They either have half a unit or one unit, as Daniela said, which makes them fermions or bosons or vector bosons.
And so it's how you distinguish between these different types of particles you get coming along.
And I think the important thing is that Daniela said it, Higgs is neither, we tend to think of matter being fermions, with vector bosons carrying the forces between them.
Fermions being things like what, electrons?
Electrons, muons, quarks, they're all fermions. And the vector bosons, like the photon and the W and the Z, they carry the forces. And the Higgs is neither of those. It's a completely on its own, in its own class, nothing like that. And that's because it's a scalar, and that's why it's a scalar as well, if you like.
And just this other term that people might not get, the couplings, is that just a measure of what a particular particle decays into, or what?
The couplings, really, in a sense, you know, you heard that the Higgs gives mass to particles, and it means that the Higgs likes to decay into particles that are massive. So the couplings, or the decay rate of the Higgs, for example, to a top quark, is much larger than the couplings, the decay rate of the Higgs to a muon, which is much lighter than a top quark.
It's one of those words we use in physics that kind of almost echoes the meaning in everyday life. I mean, coupling, I don't know, it's some sitcom from the 90s, isn't it? But it's to do with mutual attraction, it really is. It's if the Higgs is attracted to heavier particles, so we say it couples to them more, it's more likely to decay into them.
What are some of the things, John, that are out there? And I know there'll be lots of stuff in the archive that we maybe not want to delve into, but what are some of the...
I can see the fear in your eyes when you say that.
What are some of the things that physicists have sort of postulated about the Higgs that you might find? Might you find that it's not elementary? Might you find that there are more than one of them? Might you find that it decays in a weird way that would tell you something else?
Yeah, I mean, all of the above, really. Certainly, we don't know with any great confidence that it's elementary. In the theory it is, but, you know, what's the data actually telling us? We don't know whether it's alone. There could be more of them. Certainly, theories like supersymmetry predict that there are more Higgses, some of them charged, some of them different. So those are definitely there. The decays is very interesting. We started towards the end, so that you can measure the lifetime of how long does a Higgs live for. It looks like it's about 10 to the minus 24 seconds. The more things it can decay to, the faster it will decay, and you can actually measure that. We don't actually measure the time directly, really. We measure a thing called the width of the Higgs. If we can get a handle on that, then that, you know, one thing I'd really like to know is, does a Higgs give mass to dark matter? So we know that there's this dark matter out there in the universe that isn't the standard model. If it gets its mass from the Higgs, we might see signs of that by studying either the decays or the width or other properties of the Higgs. So as Daniela said, you know, we're going to have to work quite hard to see if it's hiding any more clues. But all of those things you mentioned, all of these things are things that it's not just a matter of measuring something precisely for the sake of it. It's measuring it precisely because we hope we'll get a clue then as to some of the questions the standard model leaves unanswered, which include things like that. What is dark matter? And you know, why is there so much more matter than antimatter around and stuff like this?
John, I can't let you get away with talking about the Higgs lasting, surviving for only 10 to the minus 24 seconds, which is a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second.
Is it? Okay.
I think 918. I think that's about right.
That's pretty good. I'll take your word for it.
Why is it so short-lived?
Because it decays to other stuff very quickly. It's very heavy.
That's not an answer. Come on. Okay, then why does it decay to other stuff so quickly?
Actually, it's a good question, and it's like entropy. The Higgs is heavy, so it's a lot of energy concentrated in a very small place, actually an infinitely small place, according to the standard model. That's like having all the air in this room packed into 1 centimetre. If you had it all packed in, it'd be a really dense 1 centimeter. And as soon as you stopped constraining it, it would just that 1 centimeter cube would decay to fill the whole room, because that's a higher entropy state. And the second law of thermodynamics says that entropy always increases. That's kind of time's arrow. You get more disorder. And that's the equivalent of the Higgs. The Higgs is all this energy packed in a small space. And because it can decay, the second law of thermodynamics says it will, and it will.
Daniele, you wanted to come in. I was asking about the different kind of theories out there that you might pick up some evidence of in the LHC with the Higgs, but maybe you wanted to ask about something else.
Yeah, I wanted to point out also to something else. I mean, it's something that is even more difficult than these couplings that we mentioned before. But I do think that the next run of the LHC might be able to shed some light also on a very important of the Higgs property, which is called the self-coupling. And this self-coupling of the Higgs allows you really to probe the X potential, so really to see if it's this Mexican hat, sort of shapes that we have seen in the books, or if maybe it's different, if there are other minima, and that I think it's a very important program, which we might start really to reach at the end of the LHC program, when we will have 3,000 inverse Pantoban after the iLumi LHC. This is about 100 times the data samples that we have collected until now.
So when you talk about the end of the LHC, do you mean the next run, the next 3 years?
I mean 2030, really a long time from now.
Yeah, the Higgs self-coupling and the muon decay are really long-term.
Really long-term goals, yes.
And self-coupling, sorry, does that speak to the question of whether the Higgs gives itself mass?
It speaks to that, yes, yeah.
Yeah, let's not follow up that sitcom analogy with that one.
Perhaps I can just dive in with a question there, John. I was going to ask, the success of the LHC in finding the Higgs boson and the fanfare to which that received, how has that changed the feel of particle physics? Has it become something that you've seen people scrambling to get into? Has it made it the kind of sexy science? Is it something which you think is boosting our chances of really understanding these questions?
It's interesting. I think we're still digesting, actually, the impact it's had. And it's interesting because there has been that impact that you said. It's both a curse and a blessing, because on the one hand, it was an amazing time. We've crossed off a massively important unknown on our to-do list that's been bugging us for decades. And we had this great success. On the other hand, of course, it's raised expectations enormously. And science isn't always like that. Sometimes most of science actually is patient donkey work, tracking things down, checking them out, and every now and then you get these wonderful breakthroughs, which the Higgs was. So I hope that when people have watched the whole process, it has been a long story. We certainly didn't do it overnight, so I think we did our best to explain the process and all the hard work that goes behind it. I hope there's another one of those great moments, or even better, along in the next year or two, but there might well not be. And that doesn't make the thing a failure. It doesn't make science not worth doing. It's just not quite as much fun.
I feel very excited at the moment, because up to now, I participated in several big discoveries. I was member of the team that discovered the top quark. But, you really felt like you had a bottom quark. You needed to have a top quark, It's like it had to complete a doublet of quarks, okay? Most of the theories that we have had really all predicted that we had to have something the standard model Higgs, or roughly like the standard model Higgs. So I really felt like until now, I was sailing towards the land that I knew. I was an explorer, but I knew a little bit where to, which land I should reach, Now I feel really that I have in front of me really a wide open spaces, really. It's almost an excellent time to be, an experimentalist, Yeah, because we almost have very little guidance about where to go next. So really, you know, I don't know if I should pack, you know, you know, heavy clothes or the bikini, you know. So I'm really extremely excited.
Is that not a little bit unsettling, though? When you started out with Run One, and I know this was sort of maybe overdone by the media, it was the LHC was pretty much sold as a Higgs hunting machine, and you had this very clear target to go for, but also you could rule it out if you know, within that first run. Is it a bit kind of frightening to have this entirely open landscape with very little in the way of landmarks to steer you?
I would say that is exhilarating.
Yeah, I mean, it's frightening, as you don't you know, the fear factor is good, right? If you it's exhilarating is exactly the right word, I think, and you don't get exhilarated without a certain danger.
Danny, I was going to ask you, with regards to picking up on that a bit, how you see the future of big science, because obviously this has been a huge international collaboration. It's cost an awful lot of money. The results have been pretty spectacular too. Is this sort of the start of a new wave of building of these sort of huge international collaborative machines? Will there be an LHC 2 in 20 years time, or how do you see that landscape changing?
Well, it's very interesting. I was just 2 weeks ago, I was in a meeting in Washington, D.C., where we discussed this future circular collider program, you know, these FCC programs that CERN has just started to think about, this 100-kilometer tunnel, which could reach 100 trillion electron volt energy. So that would be really a massive step forward in comparison with the Large Hadron Collider. And you see that the landscape is changing because, for example, now you have also new people at the table. You know, you have proposals, for example, from China to build maybe not as such a big machine like the 100 TV colliders that CERN might be proposing, but a similarly very challenging project. And you see that the you know, you have new players coming to the table. You have China, you have India. So I do see changes in the field, yeah. On the other hand, I also feel like, you know, because the science is becoming so much bigger, the resources needed to pull up these projects are very challenging. You know, you need really even further cooperation. And that, I think, has always been a positive aspect of particle physics that has brought people together. Because we really, you know, we really have a goal, which is a very strong scientific goal, which really unifies everybody, and which you think you see at play every time you go to CERN, where you see people from everywhere, you know, working together.
I think the other thing I'd mention is you need the technology. So a lot of what goes on at CERN and in big laboratories around the world, including at the Rutherford Lab in the UK, is developing ways to do what we did before, but cheaper and better and quicker, and using less power and all those things. And that's going on all the time, and it's going on now very intensively, especially in light of discussions of future accelerators, as the ones that Daniela mentioned.
Yeah, for example, you know, they were quoting that the new string of superconductor material that you will need for the FCC, for example, at the moment, they are just too expensive. You just couldn't build it now. You really have to bring the cost down by a large factor in order to even think about this future project. So, you know, R&D and progress, it's really essential for this big project, as John just said.
Yeah, and the other thing is that scientific program is a little nebulous still at the moment. I think there is one. Mm-hmm. I hope that we get steers from the next run of the LHC that allow us to really pull that together, because that's when, I mean, the really exciting thing with the R&D as well is people go off in all kinds of directions trying to do research and development to improve things, and rethinking from the bottom up sometimes tweaking existing techniques. But it's when you see the agreement on a scientific program and a scientific goal sort of coalesces, and then suddenly all that R&D coalesces into a real project with a real deadline and a real budget, and that can be really exciting to see. And that that's the process we're in. How quickly that coalesces will depend how well we do on the international cooperation that Diana mentioned, on the R&D, and also how quickly that science program coalesces. And that will depend partly, at least, on what we learn from the LHC next.
Can I just ask a question here? It seems that some of this is based on this kind of fairly old model of that's becoming this idea of like a world collider, where it's so big and so expensive that no one country can have it as a national project. And so you end up with places like CERN, where lots of countries get involved. Will the next really big collider be situated somewhere else? And if so, what does that mean for the role of CERN, which was set up as intentionally a way of keeping scientific expertise and expertise in this particular area within Europe?
Well, I think that the first point to make is that CERN was created to serve particle physics, not the other way around. So if CERN has fulfilled a role that's taken, actually is a global lab now, even though it's owned by the European member states, there are agreements around the world, and CMS and ATLAS are very heavily led and big participation from non-CERN member states. So whether that would be rejigged to make it more formally a global lab, or whether probably these things are done. I mean, the Americans have a very strong neutrino program that they're developing now that the Europeans want to work on. So you probably do these in sort of, rather than have everything a global lab, you have regional ones, but they're specializing slightly differently. Maybe that the energy frontier research stays at CERN, and that things like neutrinos or astroparticle physics, flavor physics go to Asia or the US. It depends. I mean, in the end, a lot of it depends on the political will of these places to have such organizations. CERN has got such an infrastructure and such a lot of expertise that I'm very sure it will have a very influential role to play in that. But in the end, if CERN isn't the right place to build something, then that's not where it'll be built. You know, it depends.
Can I jump in with another question? Sorry, Danielle, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a very quick comment. You know, that for example, you know, I worked for many years at Fermilab, where, you know, at the time where I worked there, they had the highest energy collider in the world, which was the Tevatron, okay, until the LHC surpassed it. So, but even if Fermilab is now focusing its program on the neutrino, there is still an enormous amount of R&D, for example, that is ongoing in the US at Fermilab and in other places about the magnet that you will need, for example, for this future circular collider, this FCC machine. So not because, you know, you don't have a high energy machine now in the US, the contribution of the US to high energy colliders is finished. So I think that, as you know, that it's really, really, you know, it requires really worldwide R&D to pull up. You know, to do these next projects. And so this R&D that is going everywhere around the world is still remain very important.
I want to dive in with another question, which is, we've talked a lot here about the Higgs and what we might learn, and, you know, where other avenues of research or relation to that. Are there other things which are going to come out of turning the LHC back on? Other areas of research, other perhaps slightly smaller projects or less well-known projects that they're going to be going on to?
So, I mean, the first thing to say is we talked mainly here about ATLAS and CMS, which are the general purpose detectors which discovered the Higgs. There are two other detectors there doing great science. One of them is LHCb, which is looking at for rare decays, and is in particular able to address some of the open issues in the standard model. The main one, I guess, being the fact that we're all made of matter rather than antimatter, even though the laws of nature are almost symmetrical between the two, so you'd expect equal amounts, which would be dangerous. So that LHCb will be looking at that and some other things. And ALICE is the other one, which actually does most of its best science when the LHC doesn't collide protons, but collides heavy nuclei, collides lead ions. And they're looking at quark gluon plasma, which is a state of matter in the early universe when quarks and gluons were in a plasma, as the name suggests. So when the universe was too hot and dense for protons and neutrons to stick together, and they're looking at that, what we call the phase diagram of the strong force. So those are very interesting. They're still pretty big, but they're a little bit smaller scale than ATLAS and CMS. And also don't forget that ATLAS and CMS are really general purpose detectors. So while they may have one or two big headline measurements, they're producing hundreds of scientific papers. The ATLAS passed the 400 papers level a month ago, I think. So, and you know, only maybe 50 of those are related to the Higgs. The rest are on all kinds of different things, ranging on precision measurements and searches for other stuff.
Yeah, going on into that, I mean, I do think that the search, for example, for dark matter that we have already done with Atlas and CMS in round one will get even more important during round two. I mean, we see dark matter everywhere in the universe, in galaxies, in cluster of galaxies, in large-scale structures, and we don't know yet what it is. And that's why it's quite challenging to look for it, because, if you have interaction of proton-proton that goes into two dark matter particles, you wouldn't see anything maybe in your detector. So already in run one, we found ways to look at dark matter which are very interesting, like, for example, ways that we can use to trigger on dark matter. Like, for example, if you have a monojet, so if you have a jet that is emitted by in the initial state by the proton, for example, then you can trigger on dark matter. And we have done already searches for monojet, mono W. We are going to do searches for mono Higgs. So it's going to be really, we really hope to make to go further, to really explore dark matter at LHC, which will be really phenomenal. Another thing that we are exploring is that the Higgs itself might be our portal to dark matter. There are theories for which dark matter interacts mainly with the Higgs bosons. And, we have started already to publish LIMIT in round one, and this will be significantly extended, for example, in round two.
So lots to keep our eyes open for then.
Absolutely.
I still don't understand actually how you find dark matter, which is well known for being unobservable, in a detector.
Well, what you don't see dark matter per se. So you're trying to have these monojets will allow you to trigger on the event. And then you will look for dark matter in terms of what is what we call missing transverse energy, which is the negative of the sum of the transverse momenta of all the particles that you reconstruct in your detector.
I mean, simply, if you look at the Atlas and CMS detectors, they're essentially cylinders that surround the beam. Now, if you see, as Daniel is talking about, these jets, if you see those...
What's a monojet?
Yeah, that's it. So a jet is a spray of particles produced when a quark or a gluon or something gets bashed out of the proton. A monojet is one of them on its own. Normally expect them come in pairs, one going one way and balanced by one going the other way. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. That's still true, but if one of them is dark matter, you won't see it. So you'll see what looks like a monojet, but actually there's one jet and then there's a dark matter particle. I mean, we do all this already in that we do create neutrinos. And we know that, so a W boson will often decay to a neutrino. And we can tell that they're there by exactly this technique, this missing transverse energy that Daniela mentioned. So we do it that way. We can't, strictly speaking, tell the difference between dark matter and neutrino because they both look the same. They both look like something missing. But we know, we understand very well how neutrinos are produced, how many to expect, what we expect to be produced with them. And we don't expect neutrino and a jet, this monojet thing, on its own to happen.
For example, in this mono W, you have this missed transverse energy that is expected from the W itself. But again, if you had also dark matter, you will have, modification of the shape that you expect, which are due to the dark matter. So you know how to find it, how to dig it out of this missing information, actually.
I'm going to use a really, really bad analogy, but it's the only thing that comes to mind right at the minute. If I'm looking in my fridge and I can work out that there's something missing, I don't know how I get far beyond that information. So in your detector, if you see that there's missing momentum, missing mass, and you've worked out that it's not due to neutrinos, so you say, okay, dark matter, we've created it because we know there's this hole in what's come out of the collision, essentially. But doesn't that put a really unavoidable restriction on what you can then understand about that dark matter? All you've got is a hole.
It does. But first of all, the fridge thing, right? If I look in my fridge and all the strawberry flavored milk is missing, I know that my son came home from school already, right? So you can learn some things from an absence, right? It's true that we can't learn a great deal about it, and you do need other experiments to find dark matter to show that it. What we could do is provide very strong evidence that there's a particle being produced that has the right mass and the right production rate to be a good candidate to be dark matter. The key thing we can't measure actually is how long it lives. And if it's going to be dark matter, it's got to live for almost the age of the universe, right? Because it's still there. It was presumably created in a Big Bang, and it's still hanging around making the galaxies do odd stuff. So all we can say about something we make in the Atlas detector is it lasted a few fractions of a second and got out of the Atlas detector before it decayed. So we would never be able to definitively say it's dark matter, but we could say this is definitively not a standard model particle and it has all the other characteristics to be dark matter, and then that would point the direct dark matter search people in the right direction as well.
I would say also that, you know, it depends about what else we find. Because, for example, if the dark matter is the lightest supersymmetric particle and SUSE is really true, we should find other supersymmetric particle, okay? So it depends really, having this signal in this missing transverse energy, in this missing energy, just tell you that there is something that you don't understand. And then you really have to be like a detective and found other clues in order to understand, to get into the right road, to understand what is the theory which might be responsible of what you have observed. But it will take, again, you know, a lot of effort.
But just not to understate, finding a new particle that's not in the standard model would be an amazing thing, right?
Yeah.
It would be the first time in my career that we'd done it.
But you wouldn't know whether it was one type of particle or many
different
types of particle.
Yes.
Or
yeah, we wouldn't
you
know.
Just know that you have dark matter.
Yes.
I can't let either of you go before asking a little bit about extra dimensions. It seems to be, for some reason, something that the press always focus on. But
it's cool.
Yeah, it is cool. But it's something to do with this question of why gravity is so weak, or one of the reasons is why gravity is so weak. John, take us through some of this.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that rather than just three space dimensions, there are more, but the others are curled up really small. And that means you don't actually see them in everyday life. You don't see them until you look at very short distances, which is what the LHC is. In one sense, it's the biggest microscope we ever built. So it's looking at space-time more closely than we've ever done before. And if you get to those really high energies, you can suddenly start accessing these extra dimensions, and that might show up, the various ways it might show up in the detector. The connection with gravity is that they say, well, the reason gravity is so many orders of magnitude weaker than anything else in the standard model, even than the weak force, it makes the weak force look really tough, actually. The reason gravity is so weak is because it's the only one force that is spread over all of these extra dimensions, not just over the three we know. And you don't need many extra dimensions to suddenly dilute it hugely. And that would mean that the moment you start hitting these extra dimensions, gravity would become strong, or as strong as the other standard model forces. So you effectively have what we call the Planck scale, comes down to the LHC. Personally, I mean, it's great fun. It always was a long shot, and it's an even longer shot now, because one of the best motivations for it, which I believe Stephen Hawking and Weinberg had a bet about, was rather than have something weird and odd like the only scalar boson in nature, if you bring extra dimensions into play, you can avoid the need for the Higgs. And now we've got a Higgs, so that motivation isn't there anymore. But
so is this second run at the LHC, is this sort of make or break for string theory as well?
No. I wish it was. No, it may be sort of make or break for supersymmetry. And
yeah.
If we don't find supersymmetry, then it's probably nothing much to do with the Higgs or the electroweak scale, which is what most people thought it would, most theorists would have thought it would have. Even that won't kill supersymmetry, and it certainly won't kill string theory, because you could always have them come into play at energies way higher than the LHC could ever reach.
I agree totally with John about that. In my opinion, when we speak about supersymmetry, we really refer to a wide variety of theory, models, etc. And sometimes the ones that we are able to eliminate are really a tiny fraction of a supersymmetric theory, really. So I think that it's very difficult even to completely eliminate supersymmetry after even after this run. We will eliminate some explanation, some easy explanation of supersymmetry and role in electroweak symmetry breaking, etc., but not more complicated models of supersymmetry.
Yeah, I think that there are lots of possible theories, right, and variations on possible theories. I think what the way I would phrase it is what motivations are we ruling out? So as I just described, the motivation for extra dimensions is already weaker just because we found the Higgs. It would have been a nice way of avoiding to have an odd thing like a scalar boson. doesn't mean you've ruled out extra dimensions. They could still be there, but they're less well motivated at some level because we've got a Higgs. The same applies for supersymmetry. It very elegantly solves some problems with the Higgs mass and the difference between the Higgs, the electroweak scale and the Planck scale. And fairly technical in the theory, but it really does solve them very elegantly. But if we don't find it in the energy reach of the LHC, that motivation is substantially weaker. There are other motivations for supersymmetry, some of them just based on maths, which will still be there, but they don't require it to be around here. So we'll have ruled out a motivation for supersymmetry at some level, just like we've already ruled out a motivation for extra dimensions. But that doesn't mean nature can't just throw us a surprise anyway for a laugh. You know, we are, as I think as Daniel has said at the beginning, we don't have a map right now. We're in unexplored territory, and that is exciting. So we have to keep our eyes open, even if we think something's not very well motivated. You don't want to miss it.
And we'll be following the progress of the Large Hadron Collider throughout 2015, 16, 17, and however long it carries on for. Thanks to John Butterworth there and Daniela Bartoletto.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is the biggest story in the world.
We will look back on these times and we will think, what on earth were we doing?
From The Guardian.
This is a story about people, and this is a story about possibility.
It's a story that's eluded us for decades.
It's clearly the most important story that we could be thinking about, and yet you scan the daily newspapers and it's almost absent.
A topic which The Guardian is now throwing itself wholeheartedly into.
I'd seen how we'd done it on other things.
Climate change.
Bill's simple proposition and his urgently was, this stuff has to be kept in the ground. It cannot be dug up.
So we're letting you in behind the scenes. Editorial meetings, bids for commissions. You'll hear what works, as well as our mistakes. And along the way, you can judge how we do. Is there a new way to make the world care?
That's the challenge. What can you do that will force them to sit up and pay attention?
The biggest story in the world on The Guardian.
Also looking to the future is this week's Tech Monthly coming out on Sunday. Nicola, what's in TM this month?
Well, it's absolutely packed with both science and tech features, as usual. We have a fantastic piece looking at the rise of a new wave of apps, dating apps, in fact, which are geared towards making sure that women are in control of the situation. So that's a fascinating piece on the rise of the dating industry.
Are they not normally in control?
Well, it's a case where you have several different apps now where women have to sort of verify the men who are taking part. So it's sort of like trying to keep women safe and making sure they're protected and in control of the situation, not being pestered or bugged by people. So that's a really interesting development. We also have a piece about how terrorist groups are using technology and how that's changed how they're operating. And then we have a piece by our science editor, Robin McKee, who's looking at the new craze to put probes on Venus. So Mars, that's old news. Venus is hot stuff, quite literally. And both NASA and the ESA have sort of plans on the table for unmanned missions to Venus, looking at its surface topography, trying to map its surface, trying to understand whether volcanoes are still erupting on Venus, and trying to understand why it is that Earth turned out to be a great place for life and Venus turned out to be the epitome of hell. So that's sort of the basis of that. We also have lots of other fun features this month. We have Olympian Jonathan Edwards testing folding bikes for us. We have an interesting piece about how Arctic ground squirrels are helping us to understand Alzheimer's disease. And much, much more besides. So pick up your copy inside the Observer this Sunday.
So on the missions to Venus, Nicola, when are those likely to go? And I presume they're not going to be entertaining the idea that there might be life on Venus, at least life as we know it.
Well, certainly not life as we know it. I think that's for sure. So currently these are proposals, they're plans. They're not missions which have been confirmed with a launch date. But it's all about trying to understand this idea of a habitable planet and what makes a planet habitable. Every other week, it seems there's another story about a new exoplanet that's been found in the habitable zone, which is a distance from a star which might be conducive or could potentially be conducive to life. So there's a lot of stories about that in the press at the moment. And this is all about trying to understand why it is that two planets that are sort of both potentially or could from the outside be seen to have become habitable. One, ours, obviously did, and Venus didn't. Venus has a huge thick clouds of sulfuric acid. It's got a surface temperature of over 460 degrees C. It is not a nice place to be. And so trying to understand why one planet turned out so well and another planet didn't will really help to shape ideas of what it is that influences how life may or may not evolve on a planet.
They don't call it Earth's evil twin for nothing. You can read all of that in this week's Tech Monthly and online at theguardian.com. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Mike Lamont, John Butterworth, Daniela Bartoletto and Nicola Davis. From me and all the science team, thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.